On to the next case. You may proceed.
May I please plead the court? My name is Richard Booker. I'm from Donald Sutton and Duvall, and I represent the appellant, Colin J. McCullough. Mr. Chief Justice, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
I'll start with a brief recitation of the facts and very brief recitation. This case came about as a result of a default judgment entered against my client in July of 2016. More than 21 days after the entry of that default judgment, the plaintiff initiated collections proceedings. It was the first time when I became involved in the matter. Upon being notified of the debtor's interrogatories and collections proceedings, I called the commissioner in chancery to have the matter postponed until I could actually review the file and see what my availability was. Upon reviewing the file, I filed a motion to vacate for what I believe to be a defect in service.
So was that your first appearance in court?
I did not appear in front of a circuit court judge or actually in court.
No, filing something. What I'm getting at is, I don't know if there is a distinction, but a commissioner is not a court.
Correct.
Although is a, helps the court, is officer of the court. And so what a lot of our cases involve a general appearance or some kind of appearance before a court. It's a little different because it's a commissioner. So I'm trying to figure out if there's any significance to that. And so my understanding is the first time you filed something with a court was this motion to vacate.
Correct, Your Honor. And I'd also say that I don't believe the special versus general appearance question matters. And that's because of Rule 1:1 that prohibits a circuit court judge or a trial judge do anything more than 21 days after the entry of a judgment. I think the issue got muddied in the trial court during the motion to vacate the general versus special appearance distinction. And I also submit, I was going to address this later on, that all the cases relied upon by the appellee and by the circuit court deal with the scenario where the trial is still pending. And so the general versus special appearance distinction comes about when there's no judgment. So they're not dealing with void judgment, which is what this scenario is. If the judgment was void for lack of practice.
If the idea of personal jurisdiction is that you can waive as opposed to subject matter jurisdiction, which you can't even by agreement of the parties. So I'm not sure why you can waive it when the merits is still pending versus at the back end, and you just say, okay, well, I accept what the court has done. And what you're saying is, no, it's void, you can't do that.
It's void, and the case law, I think, is very clear. It says judgment that is obtained for lack of subject matter or personal jurisdiction over the parties is void.
And I agree with that, but the question then becomes, what is the impact of the waiver, and why can you waive at the front end but not the back end?
Because it's a difference between a void judgment or no judgment, I think is the answer to that question, Your Honor, because there's no judgment in place when you make an appearance in a trial court and you make an argument. In a lot of the cases, there were full-blown trials. One of the cases cited by the appellee in the circuit court, there was a jury trial. And then after he didn't like how that turned out, the appellant tried to file a motion to vacate. So that's a completely different scenario. And it's not a scenario where the judge is doing something after the 21-day rule has expired. Because what, in essence, has happened is that the judgment's void. I mean, I don't think there's any question about that. The service statute was not complied with. The circuit court judge even made that ruling. And so now the debtor's interrogatories are void, too. They should never have happened.
Can I ask you this? Do I have my facts right? The motion to vacate was September 19, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the debtor's interrogatories proceeding before the commissioner was September 27 through December 14-ish.
Correct, Your Honor.
All right. Well, what am I missing here? Why do we need to have a bright-line rule about pre- or post-final judgment for general appearances when your motion to vacate clearly says you're only making a special appearance in the court? The commissioner's not a separate court. The commissioner's just an ancillary of the court. Well, so you made a special appearance. You've done everything you need to do. You don't need to do anything more. So I guess I don't understand why that doesn't moot the whole debate we're having about can you make a general appearance in a enforcement proceeding after 1:1 has run on a default judgment. Well, maybe, maybe not. But you didn't. You made a special appearance.
And I agree, Your Honor, but I think the point is I didn't even have to do that under the current Virginia law under Rule 1:1 and Boyhill.
But you did do it, and a special appearance preserves the right to show up and not have someone say that you submitted to a general appearance.
I agree, Your Honor. And that was more out of an abundance of caution rather than I think it's something that had to be complied with. Because, again, once the judgment is void, the circuit court judge doesn't have the authority to do anything to it. And I know you're helping me out here, Your Honor. But I think the stronger of the two arguments, and that's certainly a strong argument as well, is that he didn't have the authority to do any of this. He had to essentially reopen the case and use an illegal proceeding or unlawful proceeding, a proceeding that should never have occurred.
It's a little more complicated than that, because under the restatement and under the law, there's a difference between simply silently standing by while a void judgment is enforced and ratifying it. And we've never actually issued any opinions describing the delta between those two concepts. My question to you is, why do we need to hear? Because you made a special appearance. You actually didn't generally appear, and the trial court just ignored that.
Well, if the court is going to find that I made a special appearance, which it's my position, obviously, that I did.
Well, the first sentence says, comes now Colin McCauley by counsel making a special appearance for the sole purpose of contesting this court's exercise. All in capital letters. That's the first sentence of the first paragraph of the motion.
And if the court makes that ruling, then you don't need to address my Rule 401 point. But I think it's just as important, especially for future litigants going down the road. Because my concern is not just my instant case, and obviously that's my primary concern, but I think it sets a dangerous precedent to allow someone to show up in one of these debtors and interrogatories who's not made a special appearance like my client and I had, who's uninformed of the law, they don't get the notice of the default judgment. So they have no idea that a judgment's been entered against them until they get something saying, if you don't show up to these things, you're going to jail. And then they show up for the first time, being uneducated. And they could have appeared in front of a circuit court judge. It depends on the jurisdiction. It's not always in front of a commissioner or chancery. And so they show up and, gotcha. And so that's the overarching concern, which is another reason I think the Rule Cullen 1 and the Boyle and Slaughter and Rook against Rook cases are important. And so then going to the issue of special versus general appearance, none of the cases, again, deal with this exact distinction. And even the ones that do deal with the special against general appearance question, I believe it's Leon against Orr says that if you file something contemporaneously before you do anything, you're not waiving that special appearance. And so what the appellee would have to have this case or result in order to find that I made a general appearance was that one phone call to a private lawyer's office waives a special appearance. And I think that's what he's going to ask the court to rule in order to find in his favor. So,
would you like to reserve the rest of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Patrick Henry with the law firm of Mars and Henry, and I'm here today to represent Brooks and Company General Contractors. I'd like to address the first question you had about the special appearance. What the court found was that there was a general appearance made prior to the filing of a special appearance in the circuit court. That was the motion for continuance.
Let me stop you there, because what we just heard was it was a phone call to a private lawyer. So who is an officer of the court, the commissioner? But is there a difference between me filing a motion with a circuit court saying, please continue, and that's the court, versus an officer of the court, and it's a phone call, and it's, can we kick this can down the road? I mean, don't those seem like different things?
I would respectfully submit they're not. Okay. And the reason being, we could have had that in front of a judge in the circuit court, and he could have showed up and said, motion to continue. And he would have made a general appearance. There is no distinction between the commissioner and chancery who was appointed by the court to effectuate the role of a judge in that capacity. So I would submit there is no difference. Now, what counselor said...
So let me follow it through. So a general appearance would be made if I'm a lawyer and I make a call to the clerk's office and I say, can you put me on the docket eventually because I need to extend this out. I need time to prepare. I wouldn't be able to file a special appearance later when I actually show up.
Your Honor, I'm confused with what you're asking. If there was a case pending and I contacted the court and asked them to continue it without making a special appearance prior, then yes, that would be a general hearing.
So the only thing that happened before September 19 was a call to the commissioner?
A call and Marine correspondence, which is cited too. Now, we talked about this call. What the record reflects is that a motion for continuance was made. This idea that it was just a phone call is not in the record. What it is if you look at Judge Martin's brief in his memorandum opinion, he cites the finding of fact that he made a motion for extension of time, motion to continue on September
9
prior to that hearing.
Well, technically what the judge says is, well, first he gives like 8 bullets, and
sure,
7 of the 8 are after the special appearance,
yes,
which
sure
obviously bothered the judge. But the September 9 is, quote, defendant's counsel contacted Commissioner Grogan's office to reschedule debtor interrogatory. So that's a general appearance?
Yes, sir. What happened there was a motion. I was contacted to say a motion to continuance has been made, and then there was a letter of follow-up granting the continuance. The commissioner granted it. So it was a motion that was made and accepted by the court. And if you look at precedent back from 1916 that's been current through, and that's the Starbuck case, at Shepherd v. Starbuck, a motion for continuance is enough for a general appearance.
Right, and that's where I'm getting at. There's a whole line of cases dealing with what commissioners in chancery are, and saying, well, they're indispensable, and they greatly aid the court, and they're an arm of the court, and all that. But drawing a distinction, but it's not the court.
And Your Honor, I have not seen a case that made that clear. It was my opinion, and from my understanding of the case law, that their rulings were the same effect. The debtor interrogatory, unlike a garnishment, is not given a new case number. This is a continuation of that case. If you look in the joint appendix, it's the same case. It's issued. My understanding is this is not like a garnishment where we're bringing in new parties and it's a new separate civil action. It's a continuation. So I would submit that if you make a motion to...
So if someone, let's say a lawyer calls someone to show up at my office for a deposition, and they call the lawyer and it's, that's when my kid's soccer game is. Can we do it the next day? Sure, we'll do it the next day. So there's no papers filed with a court. Is that analogous?
It's analogous, but I think there's a key difference there.
Okay.
And the key difference being it's going to the fact finder or decision maker. In this case, whether it's a judge or a commissioner or chancery serving the same role. So unlike that where it's going to a third party.
You see what I'm just trying to figure out where these lines are, because there is a difference between a court and a commissioner, but it may be a distinction without a difference.
Well, and that's our position, that it is a distinction without merit in this particular circumstance, as opposed to, I think the bright line there is, there's a difference between speaking with opposing counsel in the hypothetical you prefaced. I think that is a real easy distinction for the court to make, that you go to the court, the judge, or commissioner in chancery, that is a appearance versus going to a opposing counsel. And if you look at Judge Marchant's ruling, what he in essence did was he looked to see what the courts had done. What was the proper process for challenging a judgment that should leave to be void? We had the Mack Dunleavy case and then the John Deere case from 1983, which made it quite clear.
But none of those cases involved a general appearance after the void judgment had become final.
Your Honor, actually, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, I believe the first case of Mack and Dunleavy did. They filed a motion to get rid of the default judgment,
right,
and a motion to stay the debtor interrogatory. So that's the proper process, would be you file an appearance and say, stay the discovery or stay the collection, stay the enforcement and furtherance of this case.
Right. Well, that was a circuit court holding, of course, and we're reviewing a circuit court holding.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think this is where it gets interesting. There really is no case from the Supreme Court on point, which is part of the reason why the circuit court here looked at what other jurisdictions do and said, well, Virginia has no case on point for a debtor showing up, participating, doing all these things. There is no case on point in Virginia.
I know that that's not necessarily the case here, but of course, when we come out with an opinion, we have to anticipate problems down the road. So there may be a situation, as with that circuit court case, where you file your injunction, there's enough time to grant it, get on the docket. But it's some jurisdictions, it's pretty hard to lickety split get on the docket with something like that. And so what happens if you file that injunction, but there isn't time to rule on it, or the court refuses to rule on it.
And, Your Honor, and I guess that's where the policy question comes in this case. The policy point we'd raise to counter that is the opposite. You file a motion to vacate, and you just never bring it for hearing. Cases need finality. Collections can't be stopped indefinitely. You participate in debt interrogatories, and then you don't like what happens next, so then you bring your motion to the court. This was, it shows this was 4+ months before it was heard.
That's and it's not hard to envisage a situation where debtors might like to drag things out.
Well, and that's the point where we have as a policy point here, Your Honor, is the lying wait approach. If you look at the record here, the notice of hearing was sent by certified mail, which received. They didn't show up for the hearing. Fine. Then they made a motion to continue the debt interrogatory, then filed their motion to vacate, and then waited 4 months to have it heard before the court. They waited 2.5 months to request a date. During that period,
what about the policy of requiring a creditor to file a creditor suit and serving process before getting a void default judgment?
Yes,
that's a
very
strong policy, isn't it?
And yes, Your Honor, that is a very important policy. In this case, we believe we did send it, did not certify that, and that was an error on behalf of Brooks & Company.
So how logically can you revive a void judgment if it's void ab initio? How do you revive it after the fact?
Well, Your Honor, I think the question is when you come before to challenge a judgment you believe to be void, the standard is whether or not there's a reason to void it, whether it's lack of service. And the court asked earlier, does it matter whether you waive it on the front end or back end? And there is no distinction. You can absolutely waive it on the back end by making general appearances and then waiving and affirming that judgment.
Correct me if I'm wrong, though, but the sentence I drew was you can repudiate the right to attack a void ab initio judgment, which requires affirmative action. But it's not the same test as general appearances, which is an implied acquiescence to a proceeding that will end up being void.
And, Your Honor, I was not prepared to discuss that distinction. However,
well, it's discussed in the Florida case, which is your main site.
Yeah, in the Florida case cited to, and we have the two cases that we cited to, the Department of Revenue versus Blocker and Johnson versus Florida Development. In both those cases, the court found that the participation after judgment in post-judgment proceedings was enough. Just participated. That was enough. They made a general appearance in a motion for sanctions, and then a subsequent, the other case dealt with another motion. So that's them waiving it on the back end, and that's what they look for. I'm not sure if I'm answering the court's question there, and I apologize.
Okay. The Florida case is hard to understand. That's my first observation. And I'm wondering if what they're looking at is acts of ratification, which is intentional acts. I know I didn't get service. It's not a big deal. Let's move on, as opposed to an implied waiver, which is general appearance, special appearance, which we've only used prior to the entry of otherwise be a void order.
And, Your Honor, in those cases, I believe they were looking at both. I don't think it was limited to this explicit saying we don't mind that the judgment may have had an issue. I don't think it requires that explicit recognition. I think the implicit would be fine. And that's kind of what I've seen in the cases, but that's obviously Brooks' position.
Counsel, I don't want to lose sight of the forest for the trees, and I want to ask you to limit your answer to Virginia law. What we have here is a judgment that was obtained without the proper process being followed. Or at least that's the allegation, and you cannot show that that was not the case. You don't have any sort of receipt for the mail. It appears that there was no service of the proper process prior to the judgment being entered. That is a judgment without jurisdiction. Once 21 days have passed, the court loses the jurisdiction over that. Is there any Virginia case where the court had jurisdiction and then lost subject matter jurisdiction due to a failure of process and the passage of 21 days, and then somehow jurisdiction springs back to life based upon a conversation with a commissioner in Chancery or any other opposite?
No, Your Honor, there is no case on point. I guess the most analogous would be when you look at the curing statute of 8.01-288, where you have cases that come forward. I think it's Hilton v. Quantum Community Group. That's 2002 in Fairfax County. And there they're looking at, there was a JAMS arbitration, question of jurisdiction, and there they allowed it to be cured, I believe, after the fact because they'd received process. In this case, what the record shows is the McCulley, his company was served. He's the sole owner, and his company was served on May 6th. He was then posted May 9th, and then on June 16th, he received notice of the hearing via certified mail. They're in the curing statute. I've seen them, I believe, after the fact, in the Hill McIntyre and Hilton Quantum Community cases, even after the 21 days, saying the process was fine. I believe that to be the fact, Your Honor. I did not look at those cases for that exact
purpose. There was simply no process. The allegation is there was no process, that there was a mailing that was required by statute. It's alleged that it was not made. There's no evidence that it was made, and you don't have the ability to deny that it was made.
No, Your Honor, we do not, and that is...
And so after 21 days, the court, it is indeed a void judgment for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. I'm just not aware of any doctrine that would allow subject matter jurisdiction to be reborn when it... Never mind.
Is it subject matter jurisdiction that makes it void, or and this is what I'm trying to understand, or is it personal jurisdiction? Because if it's subject matter jurisdiction, there's just nothing you can do to reinstate it. But if the defect that makes it void is lack of jurisdiction over the person, and the person accepts the court's jurisdiction at the front end or the back end, that may be a different answer.
Well, and Your
Professor McCullough has a good
well,
point there.
And Your Honor, that's the point I would make at first point, is that their subject matter jurisdiction was not even alleged or challenged in this case at the circuit court or on appeal here. The only challenge has been to personal jurisdiction, which again we got to the discussion of waiver, and I think that goes to the real policy concern is, in essence, we're saying as a debtor, just wait. If you believe it's void, just wait forever. Participate in interrogatories. Participate in every potential collection action, and then if something bad happens, bring it to the court.
Right, because if it's void ab initio as opposed to waivable, you can participate all day long in enforcement proceedings and just string the creditor along. And then 5-10 years later, because it was void ab initio, you spring a motion to vacate, and because it was never good in the first place, even though you actively participated and submitted yourself to the jurisdiction of the court, you wipe out all the proceedings. And that, I'm not sure that's the right answer.
And that's where our strong policy concern comes in. Okay. And that is the end of my time. We would ask that the trial court's decision be upheld.
Rebuttal.
Let's start by addressing the court's concern about whether or not a phone call constitutes an appearance in the court. And I can tell you, at least from my criminal practice, a client calls the court, says, I'm going to be late, I need a continuance. If that person didn't show up to the next court date, they're not going to issue a capias for the person's arrest because they haven't been notified. And so when I have these cases, when I'm retained and I have to get the case continued, many of the jurisdictions around this area require the signature of the client on there so they have notice. And so I submit a phone call, at least in general district court and circuit court practice on the criminal end, is not enough. There has to be some sort of signed notice, or the court has to recognize the person physically. I don't believe a phone call constitutes a general
appearance. Well, an appearance is either you're there physically in person, or essentially via the mechanism of your pleadings, your position is set forth before the court in a paper. I mean, that's what I think of an appearance, not I call and ask for something.
And that's my position as well, Your Honor, but I just wanted to address that briefly. And there also was not a motion to continue the record. It was a phone call. The court has a record to review, and you'll see there's nothing in the file.
I think the sequence is you have this phone call, it's continued, motion to vacate filed, and then appearance and answer before the commissioner on the debtor's interrogatories. I mean, that's the sequence.
Correct, Your Honor.
So then, if the phone call is not enough, is the appearance and participation enough under compulsion when previous to that you filed a motion to vacate.
And our position is it's not, Your Honor. And I believe the case law, ample case law supports that. Lear and Mitzler, I believe, is one of them. It says as long as you file it before or contemporaneously with any pleadings, you're covered. And I believe Appley's reliance on Shepard against Starbuck, is misplaced. In that case, the party showed up in front of the judge. So again, it's not just a phone call scenario. He showed up in front of the judge, and they had a hearing on the merits of the case. They had a trial, and then tried to back out after the fact. And so that's another case like the entire line cited by the circuit court, where the defendant has had the opportunity to stare in front of the judge and plead his case, and then tries to get rid of it after the fact. Here, my client never had the opportunity to have his day in court. And what I believe that essentially boils down to is that he was deprived, or they're trying to deprive him of his property without due process of the law, which also has constitutional implications. As far as the two circuit court cases relied upon by the appellee in the circuit court, Mark against Dunleavy and the John Deere case, those don't actually say what the circuit court and I believe the appellee want you to believe that they say. There's one line in each of them in the fact pattern that says something. In one of them it says somebody filed a motion to stay. And the other one it says that the parties agreed to postpone the debtor's interrogatories so the motion to be heard. That's not an established procedure. That's one line in a fact pattern in some obscure circuit court cases. It's not even part of the holding in those cases. In those cases, the judgments against the defendant were vacated because they were void. And to address the issue of personal subject matter jurisdiction, Your Honors, it does not matter in the current Virginia case law. It says both make a judgment void, lack of subject or personal jurisdiction.
Well, but we have been at pains in maybe the last decade to tidy up exactly what we mean by voidable and void, et cetera. So, I acknowledge we've said void, but I wonder exactly what that means in different circumstances.
And the Boyhill case has yet to be overturned, and that's the one that says it's you don't have against the person or the subject matter. Either one, it's void. It's not voidable, but it's void. And as far as the time frame, the appellee's saying, well, we were dragging this out. The emails will show you that I told him I have this motion to vacate. I don't want to get this heard if we can't work this out in the hall. And I don't think there's anything against public policy for trying to resolve a matter without having to go through a bunch of hoops or even up to the Supreme Court of Virginia. And so the time frame is misleading because it's not like I filed a motion and decided to see how the debtors and interrogatories played out. I filed a motion with the understanding that if we can work this out that morning, and again, that's reflected in the emails, that is part of the record, then great, we don't need to go through this hassle. And I would have had, at least in the past, when I've had these issues, especially the Bellotto law firm, call them up, this is the issue, you're right, I don't think I had service, I'll sign off on the motion to vacate, we'll have the order entered, let's meet up and see what we can do about the case. That didn't happen here, and after it became apparent that that was not going to happen here, based on content of the plaintiff, that's when I decided to move forward with the motion to vacate. And the reason it took another 2 months was because the plaintiff's counsel was not available. So to say that we just dragged this on for 4 months, I think is misleading, and I think the record will support my position on that matter. I could go on all day in circles, I think, but I'm happy to answer any questions the court may have.
All right, thank you very much. All right. Call the next case.